Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And with Sam Dingman, I am Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what's included in Arizona's application for federal money to help the rural healthcare system?
And a tiny desert concert with a TikTok star.
But first, Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin ran as a change candidate. The businessman is the youngest person ever to be elected to the Navajo presidency and was ushered into office on a wave of hope for the future of the nation's largest Native American reservation. But the honeymoon seems to be over. A special prosecutor spent 3 months investigating Nigrin and filed an ethics complaint calling for his immediate removal. Now the Navajo Nation Council is considering a motion to remove him. KJZZ's Indigenous Affairs reporter Gabrielle Pietrazio has been covering every twist and turn and joins us now to tell us more about what's been going on. Good morning, Gabe. Okay, so begin, Gabe, with a little bit about what the special prosecutor found. Like, what is Nigrin accused of doing here?
Good morning, Lauren. And Special Prosecutor Kyle Naback essentially outlined two major counts, one being nepotism, as well as the alleged misuse of government funds. Hmm. And specifically, when it comes to the misuse of government funds, using P cards, which are used for credit, travel expenses, and was allegedly paying for family members' travel while on official Navajo Nation business duty. Hmm. But went further, as the complaint alleges, to conceal the fact that family members were part of those expenses, going so far as to falsify documents, even using whiteout to conceal names and directing his staff to do so. And that's what the bulk of the complaint outlines. Mm-hmm. But there was also other counts, including having staff members, at least one, do personal duties like paying bills for the president, also doing like housework, cleaning and cooking and things of that nature while in their official capacity as executive branch staff.
Hmm. Okay, so now there is this ethics complaint, the special prosecutor calling for an investigation here for his ouster, essentially. Now the council has stepped in. The speaker of the Navajo Nation Council recently called for a vote for the vice president and the president's removal. But what happened next?
So essentially that special prosecutor ethics complaint was the catalyst for the resolution, which contained was part of a 465-page document outlining evidence to show for the malfeasance and misfeasance of the president's role as leader of the nation, as well as the vice president for being complicit essentially in part of this alleged misconduct, financial misconduct. And so now the speaker, Kristalyn Curley, is looking to oust both of them.
Mm-hmm.
That has been temporarily put on hold. A judge in Window Rock, as part of the Navajo Nation District Court, has put a temporary restraining order on that motion, which would have allowed the council to start moving to a potential vote on the main council floor as early as Thanksgiving. But that was brought to a halt just a couple days prior to that, until December 8th, at least, when there's a hearing that will determine whether or not the bill could move forward entirely.
Okay.
And that's where we're at currently. So we're kind of waiting and holding until December 8th. And then depending on how that goes, the chances of removing Nigrin and Vice President Rochelle Montoya will become clearer in the fate of that.
So waiting for that hearing. Nigrin says that this is politically motivated, though, right?
That's right. He alleges that Speaker Curley is looking to essentially replace him, take his seat in Window Rock. I spoke to her recently. She denies that claim. And it's a very tumultuous time. It continues to add to a lot of the stresses for Navajo people living on and off the reservation. We see it on social media. The president openly acknowledges that people are watching very closely what's happening in Window Rock, and it's becoming more and more prevalent as we continue. We only have 13 months left of this current administration. It's unclear whether Nigrin, who would be up for reelection next year, is going to run.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't made that decision yet. But I think he's still weighing that in previous discussions that I've had with him over the last few months.
And this has come to a head. Like recently, Nygren actually showed up at a council meeting, right, and kind of sat down and talked for hours about this.
Yeah. So there was a special session on Wednesday, and he was not slated to be a part of the meeting. The special session had actually adjourned. And a council member made a motion to allow the president to speak. He wanted to apologize for text messages that he had sent to Controller Sean McCabe that he believed were confidential or private that were leaked by McCabe, who was fired and is part of another lawsuit that the president's embroiled in, essentially, to council members. And then that went public. So he apologized for explicative language in that and for the harmful words that he had uttered to McCabe. And part of that was Carl Slater, who's the vice chair of the Budget Finance Committee. He actually pressed him on some of the details in the 465-page report that outlines alleged evidence of financial misconduct.
OK, we'll hear a little bit of that back and forth here.
I mean, when you see the innovative electric invoices, you know, that by itself should be disqualifying. Maybe there's an opportunity for you to explain yourself on those things here, but it sounds like that's not going to take place. So, Speaker, thank you. Thank you, Mr. President, for coming over here.
Yeah, thank you, Carl. I think anything that's under investigation or in the courts, I will definitely not discuss here on the floor.
Okay, so Gabe, before I let you go, I want to back up and just talk about Nygren himself. As I said, he kind of ran as a change candidate, youngest president ever on the Navajo Nation. He had this kind of exciting campaign, lots of Navajo influencers supporting him. Are you surprised it ended up here?
You know, I'm still kind of coming to terms with that as well. And it's interesting because he was presented as the young change candidate, reflective of like an Obama from years prior, Zoran Mandani in some ways, where he was, you know, capturing social media influence and visibility, arguably probably the most visible Navajo Nation president in history, just taking advantage of the social media platform and making his message and his branding very clear. And so it is a bit shocking to see how that has changed and how people have soured on his administration. It'll be interesting to see where he goes from here and what comes out of this as a result of whether the ousting does occur and whether he will seek reelection.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have to leave it there. Lots to watch for. That is KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrarazzo joining us. Gabe, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And with Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. State officials are waiting to hear how much money Arizona will get as part of the Rural Health Transformation Program. All 50 states submitted applications for the federal money, which comes from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It'll allocate $50 billion nationwide over 5 years to help rural health care systems in areas like workforce, infrastructure, and access. States expect to hear how much of that money they'll get by the end of the year. Arizona plans to start awarding grants early in the new year. Arizona's application included $57 million over 5 years for more residency slots, subsidized health education, and more workforce issues. It also asked for money to help rural providers with electronic health records, equipment, and other fixed costs, among other things. A number of healthcare and business groups signed on to a letter in support of the plan. That includes the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Anne Marie Alameddine is the group's president and CEO. She joins me to talk more about this. And Anne Marie, what is it that you're happy about in this application?
I think the governor was very intentional in listening to the voice of rural healthcare providers in Arizona to see what problems that they were struggling with in the healthcare delivery system, and that her proposal really reflects solutions for those challenges. For example, around healthcare workforce. Like, healthcare workforce has been an intractable problem for rural healthcare providers to recruit, to retain, and to keep them in their positions. And so I think that's an important initiative here that we will hopefully have funding that will help really solve some of those problems.
Yeah, and the workforce piece was the biggest chunk of money that that the governor had asked mm-hmm. for. One of the other ones dealt with behavioral health, things like maternal fetal health. We've heard all about maternity deserts in rural parts of Arizona, chronic illness prevention, things like that. How significant might that be for the rural healthcare system?
I think it's very, very significant. I mean, access to behavioral healthcare services statewide is an issue. It's an issue in Maricopa County and Pima County too, but it's really an acute issue in rural Arizona, just access to behavioral health professionals and access to care. And as you indicate, there's a we have maternal deserts right now where there are not OB services in certain counties and communities. And so we want to make sure that, you know, those deserts do not expand as there is a constriction in healthcare services with the constriction of funding that is coming into the state as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill that was passed this summer. So I think this is trying to strengthen some of our most vulnerable parts of the state.
So you and I have talked in the past about sort of the state of rural healthcare in Arizona and how at times it sort of seems like it's on the brink of it could kind of go either way. Where are we right now?
Well, I think as we look at, you know, the One Big Beautiful Bill, it was the largest cuts to Medicaid in the history of the program, $1 trillion worth of cuts. In Arizona, we have a minimum of $6 billion that will not be coming into the healthcare system over the next 6 years. Mm. Very significant cuts to the healthcare system in Arizona. And so I think we are at a tipping point in terms of we've got to figure out a way that we can kind of reimagine the healthcare delivery system in Arizona so that hospitals and other healthcare providers can kind of collaborate and share services and figure out how to work together more efficiently and more effectively so that the most important thing is that so that those the access to care remains in that community.
So you mentioned the cuts to Medicaid that are coming. I think it's probably worthwhile talking about this application in the context of some of the other healthcare issues going on, including premiums for the Affordable Care Act are going way up or are way up. Subsidies that a lot of people have been using over the last few years mm-hmm. seemingly are going away. So how do those impact what the governor is asking for here?
I think we all need to care and be tracking this issue. You know, the advanced premium tax credits, a lot of people, about 145,000 Arizonans, I think, participate in the exchange. A number of those people are able to get these subsidies to help make health insurance premiums affordable. That was what was in debate during the shutdown. There's going to be a vote, and I think it's really important for all your listeners to know that if those advanced premium tax credits are not extended, I think premiums for all of us, whether or not you're on the exchange or not, are going to continue to go up because it's a system. It's a contained system. And when you are constricting one area, it's going to expand in the other. And so, and I think we have been seeing that in all of our premiums. I think we just saw a report from Mercer indicating next year's premiums for employee coverage will continue to be higher than it is today. Mm. And I think we're at a breaking point where we need to have policy solutions that really allow for access to affordable health care, you know, across this country. But I think we've been making some policymakers have been making decisions that are going in the wrong direction.
So you mentioned $6 billion in dollars not coming into Arizona for health care. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the governor gets everything that she's asking for. That's obviously not $6 billion worth of funding. So how much of a dent would this rural health care money put into the system in the context of everything else going on?
Yeah, it's a minimum of $6 billion. That's just on the state-directed payment program that is getting ratcheted down starting in 2028. We also have the unknown of how many people will fall off access or Medicaid mm-hmm. in Arizona by not being able to adhere to the work reporting requirements that will be required in a year. But as you say, even just using our ceiling here of $6 billion, the best case scenario for the Rural Health Transformation Program is $200 million for each of 5 years. So the best case scenario is
$1 billion.
So I think it can strengthen and hopefully provide that transition to help recruitment for workforce and to build some resiliency and to prevent maternal deserts from getting worse. But I think there's hope in a new body of Congress, you know, as elections occur, as the midterms happen. You know, OBA was passed, but there can be mitigation of that legislation moving forward. There can be rollback of certain provisions. And that's certainly where, like, the American Hospital Association and our organization, ASHA, is looking at, you know, how can we start to mitigate and peel back some of the more detrimental provisions.
What are you hearing from hospital officials in some of the rural parts of the state, your members who are in rural parts of the state, about sort of how they're doing and what their next several months to years look like?
I think they're very concerned about access to care in their communities, first and foremost. I think they're anxious to look at ways that they can work with other similarly situated hospitals in innovative ways, like looking at, you know, supply chain or artificial intelligence strategy. How can you look at new delivery models of either telehealth or remote patient monitoring? Like, how can they do things differently, perhaps more efficiently than they have in the past? But it's really concerning when you look at the payer mix for hospital communities. There are oftentimes more government payers, it's more Medicaid, more Medicare patients, and patients who are typically older and oftentimes sicker with more chronic conditions. And then it's a smaller community, so you don't have those economies of scale that you might have in larger communities. So it's just, it's concerning. And I think, I just hope that policymakers do take another look at OBA and some of the more detrimental provisions that are going to impact access to care for many patients in Arizona, but also the financial impact that I think we all are already feeling. And it's likely only going to get worse.
All right. That is Anne-Marie Alameddine, President and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Anne-Marie, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And alongside Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. Laura Loomer is difficult to define. She describes herself as a, quote, investigative journalist. Critics say she's a far-right provocateur who uses her massive social media presence to give a bullhorn to racism, misinformation, and conspiracy theories. Others see her as a kind of shadow arm of the Trump administration, where she has no official role, but uses the power of her following to shape its policies and its personnel. Earlier this year, Mike Waltz was ousted from his role as national security advisor after Loomer met personally with President Trump. Last month, Trump pulled his nominee for a top role at the IRS following an online pressure campaign by Loomer. Around Washington, there's a name for situations like these, where Loomer targets someone she feels is disloyal to the president. It's known as, quote, getting Loomered. So who is Laura Loomer, and what is she up to, really? New Yorker writer Antonia Hitchens recently tried to figure this out. She published a profile of Loomer last month. In the piece, Hitchens uncovered intriguing details about Loomer's youth right here in Arizona and how her influence is evolving. Loomer, Hitchens told me, is more complex than your typical MAGA influencer.
It's not so much, why are you a Trump sycophant? Like, why do you like Trump so much? I think a lot of people kind of trip up on that question for a long time. I think I began to see the question more as like, what is the benefit or motivation for being a Trump sycophant? And I think in Laura Loomer's case, a lot of the time, calling somebody out for disloyalty can be a really efficient reason to have them removed from a position for a completely different reason. And so I think what I began to notice in my reporting was that there are a number of kind of targeted interest groups, almost like a lobbyist would work with, who can use Loomer when they want to remove somebody or push a policy and find a way of couching it in, well, this person or this institution has been disloyal and thus they should be taken out of our movement. And it's often not really about loyalty to Trump whatsoever.
Yes. Well, I want to get to that, but the origins of Loomer's media style, whatever media we happen to be talking about, whether it's her Twitter feed or her podcast, seem to be born out of this sense, at least as she expresses to you, that she sees President Trump almost like an extension of herself, or maybe herself as an extension of him.
Definitely. I think if you hear Loomer describe their rapport and their relationship, it transcends the normal way that someone would describe, you know, enjoying a politician's policies or enjoying their style. It's much more a sense of having their lives completely bound up together and of being in a struggle together against a country that's tried to marginalize them. And I think both of those characters, Trump and Loomer, for years felt that they weren't being seen by the country the way they saw themselves, which is these kind of incredibly important main characters who deserve to have a prominent place in politics. And Loomer, from the time she was a teenager watching Trump on Fox News, began to describe herself as kind of living in almost a dialogue with Donald Trump and with his life, and seeing her rise as tied completely to his rise. And so seeing herself as working with him, even if, as I mentioned in the piece, they for years, you know, he didn't know who this person was. They had no relationship.
Obviously, you know, it's impossible to know what prompts somebody to come to these types of beliefs. But there was a very intriguing detail that you included in your story that I hadn't seen previously when it comes to Laura Loomer. And that's that she has I believe it's a brother who struggles with schizophrenia, and that there was kind of a atmosphere of violence in her home. And for that reason, perhaps among others, she was sent by her parents to attend a boarding school here in Arizona in a very remote part of the desert. What was notable to you about those things?
To me, a lot of what was interesting about the kind of arc of her life was a childhood in which she describes these kind of profound feelings of loneliness, of being cut off from the world, of not really having allies or friends or family she felt she could talk to. And I think it made sense to me that Loomer's life was something that was able to be conducted online, because she'd felt for so long this intense desire to be brought into a conversation, to be able to share her thoughts. And a lot of that felt like it traced back to, whether it was her home life or at boarding school, just feeling deeply cut off from life.
So let's come back now, Antonia, to something you alluded to earlier, which is this interesting development more recently in Loomer's online activity, where she has moved beyond just targeting people associated with the administration that she perceives as disloyal, and has now started posting these long rants about things like oil policy in Venezuela. And that has led to some suspicion that there's, shall we say, more going on than meets the eye.
You know, the public perception of Laura Loomer is that she's slightly wacky Trump supporter who's developed a large social media following that's given her a lot of influence, including in the White House. But the story is more complicated than that. And in many cases, Loomer is, or at least appears to be, a hired gun who's tweeting for influence on legislation or decisions that can affect all sorts of national and foreign policy. The interesting thing to me was that she represents a new kind of player in national politics, in the sense that she wields all this influence, but because she's not a full-blown paid lobbyist, she can actually skirt many of these legal requirements that formal lobbyists would face. So you can't go and see, you know, who are your clients? How much do you get paid?
And is it correct to say, Antonia, that Loomer says that everything she's saying publicly springs organically from her deeply held convictions? But there is a very fascinating moment at the end of your story where you get to visit her home podcast studio and you see a very intriguing piece of paper.
Yes. And I think reporting on Laura Loomer, I felt like I was, at some point as a reporter, you become almost as embroiled in the conspiratorial thinking that you're trying to call out. I would follow all these leads I would be given about, you know, X person working with Loomer, Y person compensating her. And of course, if you can't really chase down the information enough that you can know that it's reportable, there's a whole web of kind of half-truths that I was living in for a long time, until really the fact-checking of my piece, where we realized, you know, here's what we can lay out that we feel really confident in and that we can also put to Loomer, and here's what will have to exist kind of for the next go-around. And I won't repeat them on the air, but a lot of them, I think, are really quite shocking allegations of who is paying her. And so when I happened to be at Loomer's house and we were kind of sitting together drinking tea on the couch, I noticed on her desk, just kind of in a quick glance, a number of different receipts that confirmed a lot of what I thought to be true, which of course I didn't use as actual reporting in the story, but that, you know, it seems like these connections are not completely coincidental. What was unique to me about the way in which Loomer would deny things was that normally, I think if you have this level of influence, you can actually kind of sell yourself to clients as, look what I can do for you. I think in Laura's case, there was almost a resistance to admitting that any of this went beyond pure loyalty. I think the idea of questioning something as being not just a labor of love was very offensive to her. And she would often say to me, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm just, you know, I'm a clairvoyant.
Well, one of many reasons to eagerly await further reporting from my guest, Antonia Hitchens, a staff writer covering politics at The New Yorker, who recently profiled the difficult to categorize, but undoubtedly fascinating Laura Loomer. Antonia, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to talk to you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
Along with Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody. And now it is time for our latest Tiny Desert concert.
Charlie Green, a.k.a. CG5, has been writing songs since he was 5 years old. And he's made it big today. But he doesn't write songs about his own life. He almost always writes songs about video games. And man, does it hit a chord. If you haven't heard of CG5, it's likely that the young people in your life have. He's got more than 9 million subscribers on YouTube, 4.4 million TikTok followers, and hundreds of songs. And he's neurodivergent. He's open about the fact that he was diagnosed with autism in 2022, and he says that music helps him express himself. Charlie lives here in the Valley and met us at Grace Records in Gilbert to tell us more about his work and play us a few songs.
I feel like I read social cues a little differently and communicate differently, and that was especially true when I was near the beginning of my life for making music, because I felt like I wanted to make music as soon as I was like 5 years old, because my dad showed me a computer program that I could make music on.
As a five-year-old.
As a five-year-old. And then I just knew that I wanted to do that with the rest of my life, because I hyperfixated so much on that.
Yeah. So you get hyperfixated on music as a five-year-old.
Yes.
Do you still make songs in the same way? How has your writing process and producing process changed over the, you know, 20 years in between?
I think I've gotten a little bit smarter since I was five. You know, maybe I mean my best songs were written when I was five. Just kidding. But I mean, the process is never the same.
Yeah.
With everything that I do, it's really hard to explain to people whenever they ask, like, how has the writing process changed? Because literally changes constantly.
That's interesting. So you don't like hear something and go with it. You don't have a lyric first. You don't have a hum in your head first. It's like it depends on the moment, the situation.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'll have all those things that you just said.
Sure.
I'll have some melody in my head. You know, usually it's like, because with what I do, I make a lot of songs about video games, and that's what people gravitate towards on my brand. With that, I have a topic in front of me. For example, Five Nights at Freddy's. I can research it, and I can write a song in whatever perspective I'm in, like somebody about to die in the game or something, or, you know, the character of the game.
Yeah.
I write in that perspective, and if I look at a game, I feel like I can come up with the sound pretty quickly of what this, I feel like the song should sound like.
Okay, that makes sense in terms of process. So let's talk about making songs about video games, because that's kind of where you begin. And obviously we heard some songs today that aren't necessarily about video games too. You also read about your own life, right?
Yes. Actually, you know what? All the songs that I sang
those
today
were
about
video games.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the funny thing is that most of the songs that I write about video games, I don't want people to just think that they're about video games immediately, especially if they don't know Five Nights at Freddy's at all. I want people to just like the song because of the fact that it's a good song.
All right, so we're going to hear a song now. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to be singing Can I Get an Amen? This song was one of the first songs that brought me out into the realm of what they call nerdcore music, which is songs about video games. And this gave me my first big push professionally. Right out of high school was when I decided that I was going to do this possibly full time or give it a shot, because this particular song was growing so much. So this song has a special place in my heart.
He comes out of the shadows to offer me his blessings. Emerging from the darkness, I pray you hear me, Bendy. I hope you come to save me from this corrupted body. I've done so much to please you. Please do the same for me. I'm your disciple, you know that's true. Look at every. Can I get an amen? Amen. Can I get an amen? Oh, oh, amen. These pipes, they flow together. These pipes, they flow forever and ever. The cogs and gears are turning so that you may live here, Bendy. The plans of this silly vision have come into fruition, but you've written your own story, and it's like nothing I've ever seen. I've orchestrated music for the episodes of a sick and twisted little children's show, and now I see you everywhere. Sacrifice is all I've shared. Can I get an amen? Amen. Take a step in here. If you run, you cannot hide. You're in danger the moment you arrive. Why you not relax? Come on, have some soup. It's probably gonna be the last thing you do. If you really don't wanna die, keep on running for your life. I am your disciple, don't you know that's true? Look at everything I've done for you. You're here and there and everywhere. My love is all I've shared. Can I get any amen? Amen. 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 Can I get an amen?
So talk a little bit about being so open about being autistic, about having this, you identify as neurodivergent, right? And you talk about that. Do you think that brings your fans in? Do you think it helps people relate to you? Do you think it changes the way that you approach it?
You know, it's not like I talk about it all the time. I mean, I think people sort of easily connect with me in that sense. Maybe they don't immediately know that I'm also neurodivergent, but there's a lot of people out there that I feel like struggle the same way. Mm-hmm. And they hyperfixate on whatever they hyperfixate on, and they're super talented, but they don't know it yet, or they want to do something with themselves, and they feel like outcasts. And it's really easy to feel like an outcast when you don't know what's quote-unquote wrong with you. Mm. I didn't really know that I had autism until I was about 22 when I got diagnosed with it. So I was always wondering, like, why couldn't I make friends? Why couldn't why didn't people think I was cool? I was trying to socialize, but nobody understood me, and I didn't really understand how to socialize very well until I was really an adult.
And I think that's so interesting because now you have millions of people online.
And they are all my friends.
Right. Well, and I'm sure a lot of them think of themselves that way, right? I mean, and in a way they are.
We can all relate in some way.
Yeah. Like there's a real connection there, I think, that happens online, even if it's not the same as like a traditional friend.
Yeah. It may not be obvious, but it's natural.
Yeah. What do you think about that? Like, do you feel like that fulfills that for you? Does it feel like you found friends in a different kind of way online because of the way you were?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do have a good group of friends from the internet. Mm-hmm. They actually live nearby now. It's kind of full circle though, because they used to be all over the place, all over the country.
Wow.
And I met them obviously through the internet, through everything that I do on the internet and through what they do. They're also musically talented, and I think we can all relate in that way. Mm-hmm. And it's just really easy to get close to them. I love my friends. I didn't have a group of friends like that before the internet. I became well acquainted with people, but not really that serious.
That's wonderful. That's good. All right, and you're going to take us out on a song. What are we going to hear?
Yes, indeed. So I'm going to be singing Somebody Real. This is a song about a show called The Amazing Digital Circus. This is about a character named Gummy Goo. there's some interesting characters in this show. Gummy Goo realizes that he's not a human being. He's not real. He's what they call a non-playable character, NPC. And he wants to be somebody real. Listen closely to my story. Don't be boring, 'cause I've seen something so inhuman. He was doing a little thieving for no reason, and I glitched into another plane. And I've learned some existential things. I wasn't human, wasn't ever nothing. Artificial and I can't explain. I wanna be somebody real. My chains are revealed. Onto the world I don't know found. Shatter my life and to meet my design. But I will not be out.
You can find a video of CG5's full performance, as well as all of our other Tiny Desert concerts, on KJZZ's YouTube channel.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Anna Hamilton. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @KJZZTheShow.